Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we'll be talking about in this episode were originally released on March 18th, 2009. Starting us off in DC is Azrael, Death's Dark Knight, number one. Now, I'll admit, I don't know that we need a new version of this character, but I'm also not positive we ever really needed the first version of this character. That having been said, overall I thought this was a fairly decent story. I mean, it set the character up, it gave the backstory on the essential part of the original character's kind of origin and what we need to know and kind of how and why they're recruiting a new one and who's recruiting a new one. And so this issue had a decent amount of kind of background and exposition for both the old and the new Azrael. Decent amount of action and characterization. I did feel it was a little heavy on the exposition, but kind of nature of the type of story they're telling, they kind of had to do that. There were a few characters here and there that I would have preferred to have had introduced a little bit better, like, I don't know, maybe a couple of names here and there. But overall, I thought this was a decent story. You know, there are a couple of quibbles I could make with the art. Overall, it's serviceable and good. The funky swords that Azrael has, at one point kind of looks like, you know, sort of a flashlight kind of a thing. It's more the angle than anything else. But overall, this was a little bit better than I was expecting, but I'll admit not having high expectations. And they did a decent job setting this storyline and this character up.
I kind of felt the same way. I was kind of predisposed to not like this issue. I kind of like went in expecting very little from it. And I think expectations have a lot to do with how you ultimately enjoy an issue, because, you know, when you go in really not expecting a whole lot out of something, and then it surprises you, like this one did, and I'm like, oh, that was actually pretty good. I was kind of expecting that to suck, and it didn't. It was a good story, you know, versus some of the other things that we've looked at recently where you kind of have some idea in your head of what you want it to be, and then it's not that, and as a result, you kind of judge it more harshly, you know, and That is kind of how this one went. I mean, I went into it saying, I don't expect this to be very good at all. I bought it because it was like really cheap, you know, on a special deal when it shipped. And, you know, then I got it. And even as I was reading through it, I was kind of like, you know. But it grew on me as I read the issue. And by the time I got to the end, I'm like, oh, that was actually a pretty decent read. And I ended up going and adding the rest of the miniseries to my my pull list, so I'll read the rest of the other two issues to see the rest of the story. So I thought it was a pretty good issue. The art was good. It was good in mood to fit the story. I mean, I agree with you on the flashlight thing. I think you're talking about that very last panel of the story in particular. It looks kind of like a flashlight. But in general, actually, not the last panel, the last splash page before the end of the story, the third from the last page.
Actually, kind of on both, you know.
And it looks kind of like, I think you're looking at the blade edge on that very last one. And his blade looks kind of like a toothpick, and then that girl's blade looks kind of like the flashlight. It's kind of weird.
Well, it's more because you've got a glowing blade, and the way the colorization is done, you don't really see the blade so much as you see the hilt of the sword, and therefore right. It looks like he's got this flashlight thing with the beam being the sword or whatever. So it's one where I think artistically maybe an outline on the sword might have helped. I don't know. but it was very much the effect they were going for. It didn't take me out of the story or anything. I just thought it was kind of funny. It was one of the things where...
Didn't occur to me until you said it, and then now that I look at it, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I can see that. It didn't bother me, you know, when I was reading it the first time. So, I mean, like I said, though, I mean, I was reading along the story, and it's like the story moved along good. It introduced the characters. You got some action. It actually made sense that the guy who's becoming Azrael is the guy who becomes Azrael. You know, what all happens. It all hung together very well. So I'm interested to see the rest of this. It is an issue that I think should have nothing to do with Battle for the Cowl. And DC is slapping that logo on it to sell a few extra copies. You know, I guess tangentially it's because Batman is quote unquote dead that, you know, Gotham City's kind of going crazy and, you know, some stuff's happening, but it's, you know, I can't imagine that this Azrael contender or the Order of Saint Dumas or any of that kind of stuff is going to have anything at all to do with a contender for the new Batman in this issues. So
I don't think it's going to be so much a contender. I do think it's going to tie in so much as he's going to get introduced to some of the Batman family and, you know, get established as a player in Gotham at this point, and we'll find out what his status quo with them is. Is he up for the running of the Cowl? Certainly not. But they wanted to get a new character like this out there. This was a opportunity for them to do so. Was it a cash grab? Yeah.
I mean, basically what they're doing is they're using Battle for the Cowl to indicate member of the Batman family of titles.
Yeah, yeah.
Not part of that particular story. Well, all I'm saying is that seems to be what that logo means at this point, not that it's part of that particular storyline or intrinsic to it. And that's fine. I mean, maybe they should just start, you know, like in the old days, they used to have the little Batman silhouette in the upper corner, and it like told you it was in the Batman family of titles, and you know, put like a little Superman shield on a book that indicates it's in the Superman family of titles or something, and make that indication so people know. But you know, it was a good issue. Like I said, good enough for me to come back and buy the other ones. So I'd give it like a high 3, low 4. The fact that I was compelled to pick up the rest of this series after being predisposed to not get it would lead me toward the higher rating, so I'll give it a 4.
I gave it a 3, and one of the main, a high 3, granted, but again, I felt there was a little too much exposition, and while there was a good introduction and it moved into the action and stuff for the main character, I felt that there were enough other characters that played pivotal enough roles in the story that weren't properly introduced to my satisfaction that kind of annoyed me a little. I mean, if you go to the page right before the staple, you've got this group of 5 people basically being tasked to go hunt down the suit of Staros that Azrael wears. These guys are never really introduced by name anywhere in the story. Now, is that a huge problem? No, but it's a little frustrating. You know, the person hiring them, I don't think, is ever mentioned by name. You know, I'm pretty sure it's Talia, but, you know, it's...
I thought it was Talia. But you make a good point. I mean, it's like, you don't know. You think it's Talia. You know, and yeah, you know, you get, like, Merlin and some of these other people, and it's like, you really don't know who they are. And I mean, I was going to ask you, it's like, okay, well, that one guy with the bow is Merlin. And you know, who is, I didn't know who all of, but I don't know that it was essential that I knew who all of them were. Cause you know, when I think back on it to, you know, some of the comics I read when I was a kid with lots of characters in it, I mean, they didn't necessarily name every single character, and I might have picked up a book and, you know, it's just like, oh, who is that? It, And then over time, I kind of figured out who they were, but they didn't necessarily name every character in every issue. So, I mean, the main character certainly.
I mean, they don't need to name every character, but, for the back half of the book, these five are, key players at, certainly the last fight scene and stuff, and they had opportunity to mention names. These guys, without that, are just cannon fodder.
Yeah, there were certainly a couple of points. Yeah, there were certainly a couple of points where, I mean, a couple of them could have referred to one another by name, and you could have at least gotten some of that mystery out of the way.
So again, not a huge deal, but something where I think they could have made the story a little bit more accessible. But again, they packed a lot of information into this issue with the amount of exposition they had.
I love the cover, the Gillum March cover, and then the little preview of the second issue that they had at the back looks really nice too.
Yeah, it is a good cover, and the cover for the next one looks really good too.
So next up, we've got Wolverine number 71, part 6 of Old Man Logan.
This is one that I'm a little frustrated by the scheduling delays between the issues. It's kind of killed the story momentum for me. Now, on the upside, this is a story that doesn't really rely heavily on story momentum. Because, I mean, the situation is reestablished in the first panel, and it's like, oh yeah, that's where they are. And even if that's all you remember or all you know is that's where they are, it moves from there. So it's not one where it's like, oh crap, what happened with these characters? Where did they leave off? And stuff like that. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's been long enough since previous issues that, I've forgotten some of the stuff, but it didn't negatively impact the reading as much as it might for some other books. And really, this is a good story. It's excellent art. And I enjoyed this issue a lot. I think it is accessible enough that it could kind of, I don't want to say work as a standalone issue because I don't think it gives great resolution, but almost as an entry point if you needed it to. Certainly as a re-entry point, it works.
Well, it kind of by definition is a re-entry point because it's been so long since the last issue, which to that extent, I think they do a good job of in almost every issue, as you pointed out, since there is such a huge lag in between issues, the fact that you can get back into the story and kind of re-enter it, at least for me, since I read so many other comics, it's like, God, I don't even remember when the last issue came out of this thing. And, it's been months at least.
Well, I looked it up before we started, and the previous issue came out on January 2nd, so it's been about 2.5 months.
Yeah. So, I mean, a couple of hundred comics have gone under the bridge since then. And you got back into the story. There were some very cool story beats in here as they went along. And, again, they leave you off on a nice moment that, you're like, okay, cool, what's going to happen next? Kind of like, last issue, with the venom-possessed Savage Land dinosaur that was chasing him down, and then they opened the story on that beat, and you're kind of like, okay, yeah, I remember now. I mean, if you had like quizzed me before I opened this comic, and said, okay, how did Wolverine number 70 end off? I would not have been able to tell you, a venom-possessed Savage Land dinosaur was chasing him down. I just didn't remember that. But then, like you said, once I opened it up and kind of read it, and they have the little previously blurb that kind of like brings you a little bit back into it, and then you turn the page and there it is, and you're like, okay, now I remember. They give you enough of that information in the story that you get back into it, and then it starts moving along. It was well done.
Yeah, the only thing that really stops this from being a five for me is the scheduling. For me, a five out of five has to be not only a perfect individual issue, but really fit seamlessly into the bigger story it's trying to tell, if there is one. And it's hard for me to really judge how well this fits into that bigger picture because it's been so damn long since some of the previous parts have come out. I mean, this storyline started back in June and really, literally has no end in sight. You know, we know that 72 is going to have the next part of this, and then after that, who the hell knows?
Yeah, they have decided. Apparently, they announced it at a convention, not any place like, you know, previews catalog or anything, or I don't know. I don't remember seeing it on online, but I don't read every single news site every day. But the last part of this story is just going to be published in a one shot somewhere at some point in time. They will solicit it. That will finish off the story. So it's part eight is going to move out of the Wolverine comic and just be told somewhere down the line, which, as you said, since it hasn't been solicited, you don't know. Now, I would hope that since it is a one shot, that when they finally do solicit it, that will actually mean that last part is ready to come out when they say it's ready to come out.
I would certainly hope so. It would be inexcusable if that's not the case.
And, you know, to their defense, you know, for Marvel, I mean, they've got Wolverine and they got the Wolverine movie coming out, and I just don't think that they can handle having their Wolverine title not coming out for months and months and months at a time when the Wolverine movie's coming out in a couple of months.
If they only had the one Wolverine title, I would agree with that, but now they've got one for, you know, every day of the week, it seems like.
Well, they do, but this one is Wolverine, period. I mean, it is the Wolverine title.
Fair
And,
enough, fair enough.
you know, which, you know, is a good reason why you should not put this team of people in any normal title. You know, having them do, or at least having Steve McNiven do, I'm already drawing. What's the crossover?
Civil War.
Civil War. Oh, jeez. How soon they forget. You know, having him do Civil War, you know, fine. There were huge, huge, ridiculous delays related with that one also, especially near the end. And, you know, at least it was not in the regular titles, although, because that one was crossing over in a lot of other stuff, right? That actually caused delays of lots of other Marvel books. So the interesting thing to me is Steve McNiven, he's a great artist. He does not appear to be capable of putting out a 7 or 8 issue series. After about issue four, it just seems to get worse and worse on the delays. And maybe if Marvel wants to keep using him, they need to do two things. They need to start putting him on 4 issue story arcs. They need to be in isolated series, and they have to be, like this one, self-contained. So, while he was delaying the hell out of this book, it's a good story and everything. I'm not complaining about that, but at least it's only delaying the Wolverine book. Whereas Civil War, a lot of those delays, they delayed all kinds of books across the entire Marvel line, you know.
No, I agree with that. The fourth part of this storyline was a month or two late, and I totally agree, though, that if you've got a team that you know, for whatever reason, needs a little extra time, particularly with a story like this that was not time critical, let them get it in the can. Now, for a smaller publisher, that could be hard, that could be difficult. I would hope for Marvel and DC that they're able to. Certainly, maybe not for everything, but for things such as this, Civil War, Final Crisis, whatever, stockpile issues.
And I only use 4 issues as an example because, I mean, it's a little easier to swallow to, you know, stockpile, you know, those 4 issues and get it going so that the thing can come out without delays than, you know, stockpiling 7 or 8 because that's just going to take that much longer. And there are plenty of four-issue stories that can be told.
Right. I would have enjoyed this a lot more if it had been coming out on a monthly basis and had that sense of story momentum. If there was the, oh yeah, I remember where this kept, you know, left off and I'm waiting for that next part. And the fact that they've kind of, you know, thrown that out the window frustrates me. This is something that I think is pushing people towards trades because you avoid that frustration entirely.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, however painful it is trying to follow and wait for this issue coming out monthly, I think that as a trade, Marvel is going to have a perennial hit on their hands with this one that'll stay on their backlist. And it will continue to sell for years to come. I mean, it's a really, really good story. It's got beautiful art. And, you know, once you take the delays and the frustration that, you know, you're feeling as it goes along, because you just want to see what happens next in a reasonable period of time and have some kind of end in sight, you know, once you take that out of the equation and it's finally done and you've got a single cohesive work that is, you know, traded on their backlist, this thing will sell for years and years and years down the line.
Well, you know? And one example of where the story is suffering because of these delays is if you go to the page at the staple. It's a nice page, beautifully drawn. I understand what's going on in this. You know, it's a three-panel sequence. You got a guy, a particular guy. No, it's Dr. Doom. He's looking over a city. We see the spider buggy go by. We cut back to Dr. Doom, who's apparently noticed that. Okay, that makes sense. But I have zero context in the course of this particular issue as to why the hell that matters. And I can't even recall if Dr. Doom has shown up in the previous five parts. It's been so long since I've read them.
I'm just kind of thinking it's like when you look at that map, you know, it's like, what's kind of weird, and I shouldn't have looked at the map, because this map is like so geographically screwed up that it just frustrates me every time I look at it. Because, okay, last issue, as I recall, they were at the place on the map called Dwight's Toll, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Then, in the scene before they're with Dr. Doom, they are with Emma Frost at the Mutant Forbidden Quarters, which looks like it's at Chicago, if I'm reading the map right.
Or between Doom's Head and Chicago.
Somewhere between Doom's Head and Chicago. And maybe I just don't understand exactly where Mutant Forbidden Quarters is, because it kind of looks like once you're at the Mutant Forbidden Quarters, going through Doom's Head is going to be backtracking.
Yeah.
The way the map is written. You know, so it's like, okay, they're at Emma, and then they're driving by Dr. Doom, and it's like, well, why exactly? And then the next scene, they're in Osborne Falls, which...
Osborne City.
It's interesting, because it's Osborne City, or actually Osborne City, I meant... They're in Osborne, it says Osborne County, Ohio, on the page, as opposed to Osborne City, which, why not make it consistent? And then they get to Pym Falls, that's where I got the falls from, which makes sense, but then it's Pym Cross on the map, and it's just little things like
why
that.
Why have a map if you're not going to use it while writing the story? That's ridiculous.
And it's just like little tiny differences like that, just the anal retentive, you know, person who reads and collects comics and me get bugged by little inconsistencies like that. You know, it's like, okay, why is it Pym Cross here and why is it Pym Falls? And if there's two different places, Pym Falls and Pym Cross, what do you gain by, you know, having the two and using the two differently like that? And it's just like, it doesn't make sense to me.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. And I hadn't caught the inconsistencies on the names versus the map, but it really throws the whole question of why bother with the map.
It's just like I said, I mean, I shouldn't even look at that map because I like maps. It's like every time I look at the map in this one, it just bugs me because it's just not right.
Yeah. At this point, anyone who hasn't read this, I would say wait for the trade.
Oh, yeah,
Put it on your
definitely.
Christmas list for 2012.
Yeah. I will suspect that by Christmas 2010 it will be out.
One would hope.
Yeah, I mean it. This is a really good story. I gave it a 4, just because the scheduling stuff prevents it being a 5 in monthly format. I think as a standalone work, I'm going to suspect that this will be a 5 out of 5.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. If the later parts of the story keep up the quality it's had so far, I see no reason the trade wouldn't be a 5 out of 5. So hopefully that'll be the case. I look forward to them finishing the story some year. And I'm also curious if we'll ever get a connection between this stuff, the Fantastic Four storyline, and Marvel 1985. Shall we move on to our other book for the week?
Invincible, number 60. That is a cool cover.
Oh yeah. Now this is the Invincible War. I mean, I know we did Invincible not all that long ago, but I really wanted to talk about this issue because it's billed as the crossover event of the decade, all in this one issue. And I mean, this cover, yeah, it's a double gatefold. It is.
A 4-panel wraparound cover.
Yeah. And it's nice because it's got pretty much all the major players these days, superhero-wise at least, in the Image universe, as much as it is a universe, and even a couple from a few years past.
This is an example where it's like, I have no idea who all the characters are. I know who a lot of them are. I don't read everything from Image. I mean, I certainly know who. I mean, I read Dynamo 5, so I know who the Dynamo 5 people are. I know Velocity because I read that pilot season thing. I mean, obviously, I know who the major, Spawn, Shadowhawk, Savage Dragon, Witchblade, Super Patriot, some of those. And of course, I know who the people from Invincible are, and Brit, because I read that. And it's interesting to see Madman on there, because I know that Image puts Madman out, and I kind of like having him in the Image universe is kind of interesting. See Jack Staff on there. I've never really read Jack Staff, but he has an iconic enough outfit that I kind of know who he is when I see him, But some of these other people, like on the far right panel, the guy with the big hammer, I have no idea who that is.
I think that's one of the guys, maybe from Capes.
Okay. And, there's some other people. I mean, I know Firebreather, the Pit. There's just lots of characters on here, and it's cool. You look here, you see the Darkness, the Astounding Wolfman, and it's just like, if you like lots and lots of different superheroes, it's very cool, and this cover is a really, really nice cover. I mean, it's almost like worth the price of admission just to get this cover and look at it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, to me, it's a really nice cover, but to me, it kind of seems like a George Perez light cover. Because if Perez had drawn it, it'd have about 10 times the number of characters. But the way it is, you can really see all of the characters. They're not buried in the background or anything like that. And it gives a good kind of representation of kind of the main players or whatever in the Image universe.
Now, that said, when you move to the story, I like the story. I like the idea. I think it suffered from trying to cram it all into 32 pages.
I wouldn't say it suffered. I would say it could have easily been 64 pages. It had enough story that it could have filled more space.
The reason I say it suffered is because, pacing-wise, there are things that were not accomplished in here. Like, well, there are plenty of pages to do it, but like Angstrom Levy, right? They spend 3 pages kind of on the setup there, they don't really refer back to, you know, what issue that happened. You know, that would have been nice to have a footnote.
It's funny you mention that because I really think the first page that had a months ago thing should have had a C invincible whatever.
Right. And then they don't really bring Angstrom Levy's, well, maybe they do somewhere, but they don't bring it up by name. I guess they figure if you're reading Invincible, you know who that is. However, you know, I'm going to imagine that people might pick this comic up because they see Spawn or Witchblade or Savage Dragon or any of the other characters on it and, you know, say, "Oh, that's cool. Let me try this out." And they don't, you know, Kirkman could have put something in here that kind of gave you a short recap of who the hell Angstrom Levy is and what his deal is and this kind of stuff. And he didn't do that. And then, I mean, I'm not I really like the issue, but there are things in here because you have so many characters in so short a period of time that it was almost like you were fast forwarding from point to point. Like, as an example, if you go to the two pages before the staple, it's the issue where Pitt's like doing the thing to the Invincible, right? So actually the page before that, so Invincible flies in with Adam Eve, right? On the page before. And then you read this page, and I'm looking at the panels, and then the next thing you know, he's flying out with Adam Eve, but I don't see any kind of a resolution as to what happens to Adam Eve. And since that's a key story point later on, they don't actually even show it on panel.
I agree with that, and one of the issues with this is it's called the Invincible War, and it's because this Angstrom Levy guy has gotten evil versions, if you will, of Invincible from parallel worlds to attack this one. So you've got people in variations of his costume, and some of those look a lot alike. The version that Pitt is fighting on the outer panels of that double page thing is the same basic costume as the one, I guess, Cyberforce is fighting there, except the colors are inverted. You know. So, I mean, there are some other differences in the costume, but you know what I mean. So it's a little confusing. It's like, now wait, which version of Invincible is who fighting? So, I can see that. I agree that they kind of did the injury to Adam Eve completely off panel.
And then another thing is like you're assuming, again, from the story, that this Invincible has picked up the Pit and flown him up really high in the air, and then, you know, the Pit does what the Pit does, and then, you know, whatever. But they don't actually set that up either. And all I'm saying, you know, is that Kirkman's trying to cram so much story into so limited a number of pages that he shorthands a lot of stuff that you really have to assume that a lot of various things are happening between the panels, and you know, a lot more so than in a normal story that he writes.
True, but a lot less so than, say, in Final Crisis.
Oh yeah, I'm not comparing it to that. I'm just saying, you know, for me, there were a lot of cases where it's like, oh, okay, I'm looking at point A, I'm looking at the next story beat, and it's like, okay, well then X, Y, and Z must have happened somewhere between the panels that I didn't see it. And gee, I wish I would have seen that. You know, and I can understand, again, you know, in the 32 pages, whatever that he had to work with here, how that was necessary. But, you know, it's still a little bit frustrating.
Well, I mean, this was definitely kind of the highlight reel of the event because I agree with you that a lot gets, quite a bit happens between the panels, between the scene transitions, etc. Maybe a little too much. I certainly, you know, would not disagree about that. But for what this set out to do, which was fairly aggressive, it did a surprisingly good job at this. While I would have liked to have had a what issue it was from kind of caption on that first page of the months ago scene, you know, everything else was great. It was a good premise for the event. it made perfect sense why Invincible was at the center of it, because it's literally all about him. There were tons of guest stars, but really most of them only make cameo appearances. A couple get to speak, most get to fight, a lot get to bleed. But again, this is Invincible, not, you know, Invincible and Friends or what have you. And I'm happy with how it went down. Could it have been better? Yeah, it needed more space. This was a big story with a ton of characters. And, you know, I'm really curious how or if this is going to get referenced elsewhere. You know, are we going to see, you know, this get touched on over in Youngblood, over in Savage Dragon, over in Witchblade, all that other stuff? And I don't know.
Well, that is interesting. And, you know, the other thing that you could take from this, since there are zillions and zillions of parallel worlds here in the Image universe, you know, and we're seeing this mainline Invincible universe, right? Mm-hmm. That Angstrom has pulled all these parallel versions of Invincible into, and you see, you know, all these different Image characters. I mean, you could explain it away that if there is a particular, you know, like the Spawn title could be in one of those other parallel universes that didn't get devastated by the Invincible War. You know, the real main one,
yeah,
is one of the ones that, you know, not this one. And the same thing for any of these. So given what happened here, I would say that it would be a landscape changer for any Image comic that actually chooses to acknowledge that this happened.
Oh, yeah, it has to be. I mean, you just look at the devastation. I mean, when they do the day four stuff at the end, you know, it really does a better job kind of showing the impact of this event than happens in most crossover storylines at Marvel and DC.
Now, for people who are unfamiliar with the Invincible character, I mean, he's basically Superman. You know, kind of like, well, he's a kind of half-breed. I mean, he's a half Viltrumite. His father was Omni-Man and was a Viltrumite, which is a, you know, Kryptonian, essentially. It's, you know, an alien planet of people with massive, massive superpowers, the standard, you know, strength, flight, invulnerability, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, his father had him with his mother, who was human. So I guess, you know, he's half Viltrumite, but he is, you know, very, very, very strong. And, you know, so it's kind of like if in the Superman books, you know, in the new Krypton storyline, if all those Kryptonians decided to start beating the living crap out of each other on Earth, you know, what kind of collateral damage would there be if there was, you know, just tons and tons of, you know, really extremely superpowered people having a knockdown, drag-out fight all over the place and just not caring what kind of collateral damage goes on. That's one interesting thing that isn't really touched on in here is as the stuff is going on, no one's really, and again, not a lot of room, you know, but nobody's really reflecting on, wow, we're really messing stuff up here, you know?
Yeah, the civilian death toll here has got to be enormous.
Well, if you look at that panel that's got the eight different Invincibles from that are left from the different worlds, the day three one where they're showing them kind of like hovering over, I mean, you see, so that's like Chicago and New York and Paris and London and Moscow, and I don't quite know what, no, I guess that's Sydney on the right. It's got to be Tokyo because there's some Japanese writing.
Yeah.
The left-hand one, I'm assuming, is Los Angeles because it's got some palm trees in it, you know. But it's like, you know, they're showing all these major cities that are just totally devastated. And, you know, you're right. I mean, there's got to be tens of millions of civilian deaths in this thing.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that's interesting with that page is look at the various Invincibles. Look at the ones in the second panel of those two pages. I mean, those are ones that in a fight sequence look similar enough with the grayish costumes and stuff, you might get a little confused. Oh, wait, which is which? You look at the two closest to the page gutter there, which have fairly similar costumes with the black leggings, the blue boots, the yellow eye type stuff. One has a mask, one doesn't type stuff. They're not identical costumes, but again, close enough to be confusing. You look at the two on the last two panels on the far right there, with the blue and the black predominantly, that are kind of almost inverted color schemes with slightly different masks. Add that to the third panel on the other page, where you've got a guy in a primarily black with the eye in the middle or whatever. There should have been more variety in these costume designs. It should have been something that at a glance, like that's number, you know, one, number two, number three, number four, whatever, with less possibility for confusion. Because in so much of the previous pages, we were seeing bits and pieces of these guys as they were fighting, and it got a little confusing. It didn't really matter which was where to a degree, but it did get a little confusing in places. But overall, I really think Kirkman delivered on what he kind of promised to do here with a huge event and, you know, doing it all in the pages of the book. And certainly this will impact the Invincible title going forward. Hopefully it'll, you know, have some impact on other books. And really, the two things I would have liked to have seen that would have made this absolutely perfect, I think, at least as much as it could be for a 32-page story, because I agree it needed more space, was, like I mentioned before, a editor note or something, footnote at the first page saying, hey, this months ago references this other issue. And then the other thing would have been if the letters page had included a list of all the guest stars, which pages and panels they were in this issue, and what books they're from.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. I hadn't thought of that. That he could have used the text page to do that. I'm going to just be curious. Like I said, I mean, I'm not going to mind that much if all the other Image characters don't refer back to this.
I'm right? Okay with that too, yeah.
Yeah, but Astounding Wolfman is going to need to do it because that's a Kirkman-verse character.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so... And that's going to have an effect on the Astounding Wolfman book.
What was the Astounding Wolfman's status last he was seen? I'm trying to see where he is in these fights.
Well, he's in jail, and then the jail gets all smashed up, and now he's not in jail. Cause, you know, they don't actually show him, you know, laying all beaten up or whatnot. Mostly it's like, the fight has blown through, ripped the jail open in its collateral damage, and he's actually fighting some of the other bad guys that would have maybe escaped from the jail.
Well, it looks like he gets zapped by somebody. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's true, but just looks like, you know, probably knocked out. It's by this other character at the bottom of that page who...
Who's clearly been an Invincible before. I remember the character having been an Invincible, but nothing about him.
And he'll come back later. I'm assuming, you know, Wolfman just, like, knocked out by the electrical blast or whatever.
That makes sense.
Because, I mean, you do see, like, for instance, I'm assuming most of these characters are not dead. Like, you see, well, except for that one guy who looks like he's ripped in half there. You know, Savage Dragon, you see him, he's, like, all beaten up, but then he's awake on the next page and, you know, surveying the damage. So, you know, just because they show someone knocked down, all beaten up, doesn't mean they're necessarily dead or anything.
Yeah.
Although, on that page there, this is the page with the staple. Mm-hmm. On the left one, you see Savage Dragon there. Who's the guy to the left of Savage Dragon who it's just his torso?
I don't see enough of the costume to really identify him.
Oh, you know what? That's an Invincible, I think. That's an Invincible in the Viltrumite costume.
That could be. Of course, ripping that guy in half doesn't seem easy.
Yeah. But, you know, there's another invincible that's dead that's got like a madman yo-yo around his neck, and it doesn't seem like madman would be able to take down an invincible either.
Yeah, because that guy's neck is clearly snapped, and I don't know what kind of thing that yo-yo's made out of, but I don't see that happening.
Well, that guy was fighting Shadowhawk and Madman.
There is no way they could have
And
snapped his neck.
neither of those two guys have the stuff to take down that guy. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe not every invincible is quite as invincible in the different universes.
Apparently, yeah.
But it was good. I think, just to pick up, it's got a really great cover. You just got a lot of mayhem going on, a lot of cool action sequences. It's basically a big extended fight scene and just, crazy stuff happening. You get your money's worth out of the book. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, for me, this actually got a 5 rating.
Yeah, I mean, I gave it a 5 also. I mean, I got some little quibbles or anything like that, but I mean, given what Kirkman set out to do, I mean, it was about as good as you could do in the constraints that he was working under.
Yeah. If you were expecting all of the guest stars to actually have meaningful speaking lines and arcs or whatever in this thing, I mean, you gotta be kidding me. There's just not room for that. So this was good stuff. I really enjoyed it and was impressed.
Now, outside the context of this was a really good week of comics for me. I mean, I read a lot of comics on Thursday night, and there were some really good issues that came out. There were a bunch of number ones that came out that were really very, very good. I read Groom Lake number one, and I gave that a 5 out of 5. That one blew me away. I thought it was excellent, excellent story. Ben Temple Smith art, Chris Ryle. We interviewed those guys a while back, and the actual issue, it was really good. And the Ben Temple Smith art was some of the better examples of his art because it was a little less, because of the subject matter, it was a little more sci-fi than the kind of horror mystery. So it was a little less malevolent and all that kind of, chaotic. It was a little tighter. It was more like his art on Fell than on something like maybe Welcome to Hawksford. But I love that book. The Star Trek Crew by John Byrne. He knocked that out of the park. I think John Byrne has a real love of the Star Trek characters, and it really shows when he does a Star Trek story.
Yeah.
Because if you're a Star Trek fan, he did an excellent, excellent job on that book. Bad Dog number 2, that's not in your wheelhouse, but I love that book. That book was great. And the Potter's Field one shot was a great, great story.
Yeah, enjoyed that.
Hotwire came out from Radical number 2. God, that is so good. The Steve Pugh artwork in that is beautiful. Ridiculously beautiful. Johnny Monster number 2 continued to be good. I got it. Did you read Johnny Monster?
No, that was one that, again, budget cuts, I haven't been able to. I didn't pre-order the second one and haven't had it in the budget to add it.
You missed seeing General Breitel.
Ah.
Then what else was out? X Factor. Peter David continues to do a great job surprising us with stuff going on in that book.
Agreed.
Outsiders number 16 did a. Re I just want to mention that one because it did a huge reversal for me because I was really kind of on the fence about that book after the special and the first issue. They were kind of like meandering around a little bit. I thought number 16 was significantly better, and I had actually stopped ordering that. And the issue 16 that came out here was good enough to get me to put it back on my pull list.
I thought it was good, but the whole bit with, and you're this part of Batman, and you're this part of Batman, while interesting, seems like stuff that, is similar ground to what we've had for the last couple issues. If they had, I mean, they needed.
But I liked it because they hadn't said it before.
True, true. They needed to do that, but I wish they would have gotten a bit further into the action than just starting to investigate what's going on.
Well, I wish they would have had that scene last issue. You know.
Yeah, that scene, the last issue in the special, all should have been merged into a single good story. Yeah.
But I'm hopeful is where that's moving. Dark Avengers was good. Zorro was good. You know, just lots of good comics came out this week.
Cool.
I think I've pared down my list. You know, it's like a lot of stuff I get. The only one I read this week that I really didn't care for was Rawbone from Avatar, the Jamie Delano pirate story, which is it just kind of hit me the wrong way.
For me, I got 19 books. A couple of them were final issues of things, such as Young X-Men, Ultimate X-Men, Amazing Spider-Girl. It was kind of interesting. I had a number of Marvel titles, actually quite a few of the Marvel titles I was getting were not in the mainstream universe, between Ultimate X-Men, Ultimatum, and Amazing Spider-Girl. Got the second issue of Greatest American Hero. It's still a retelling of the origin with some updates here and there. It's good. It's entertaining. Felt the first issue was a little stronger than the second. I completely agree with you on Star Trek Crew and Potter's Field. Both of those were really good. I'm continuing to enjoy Trinity. Zorro, like you mentioned, was really good. And Amazing Spider-Man was one of the other ones I got, which I enjoyed too. So, good week for comics.
Yeah, I really, really like what they're doing with Spider-Man since the brand new day. I mean, we said it when we reviewed the book a little while back, but this character assassination arc that just finished was a really good story. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, how they're going to be doing the run-up to issue 600.
I think they're doing some good stuff, but I would like to see a little bit more cohesion between the different arcs and a sense of it feeling a little bit more unified versus, you know, Wade coming on for a couple issues, followed by somebody on for another couple issues, while they're still kind of in continuity with each other. They don't mesh as tightly as I'd like them to. But that's made up by the fact that, again, these are some of the best Spider-Man stories we've had in years. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that pretty much does it.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Oracle number 1 from DC, X-Men Sword of the Braddocks from Marvel, and Top 10 Special number 1 from Wildstorm.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.